These voices made headlines this week.
I am prepared to veto any bill that has as its purpose a federal bailout of New York City to prevent a default.
The words of the bill are the words of Archie Bunker, and the music of the bill is the melody of Herbert Hoover.
Foreigners are trying to get out, but we seem to be surrounded here right now, and there is intermittent fighting going on at this moment.
Voices in the headlines, the sounds of the news this week gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC News. I'm George Caldwell, ABC News, New York.
I can tell you, and tell you now, that I am prepared to veto any bill that has as its purpose a federal bailout of New York City to prevent a default. I am fundamentally opposed to this so-called solution.
The message by President Ford at the Washington Press Club on Wednesday seemed to complete the final chapter in New York City's failing attempt at heading off bankruptcy before the end of the year. The president explained why he would not allow federal money to be used to prevent New York City's financial collapse.
Any attempt to provide a federal blank check for the leaders of New York City would ensure that no long-run solution to the city's problems will ever occur.
Instead, President Ford said he would submit to the Congress special legislation giving the federal courts authority to preside over an orderly reorganization of New York City's financial affairs should the city go bankrupt.
In the event of default, the federal government will work with the court to assure that police and fire and other essential services for the protection of life and property in New York are maintained.
The president was also sharply critical of Mayor Abraham Beam and his predecessors.
Certainly, I do not blame all the good people of New York City for their generous instincts or for their present plight. I do blame those who have misled the people of New York about the inevitable consequences of what they are doing or were doing over the last 10 years.
The president said the people of the U.S. would not be stampeded or panicked by a few desperate New York officials and bankers trying to scare New York's mortgage payments out of them. New York's Mayor Beam was quick to react, saying the president's speech was nothing less than a declaration of impending default.
The president, in opting to do nothing to prevent the city of New York from facing the consequences of being unable to meet its debt obligations, has created a climate of crisis and confusion, which, if unchanged, will lead directly to a default.
Mayor Beam's angry response was echoed by New York Governor Hugh Carey.
After deliberately ignoring every painful step we have taken to undo the errors of the past, Mr. Ford suggests that we can avoid default on our own. This is fiscal illiteracy. If we convened a special session of the legislature of this state tonight at midnight and tripled our taxes, if we cut every human being off the city payroll tomorrow, we could not avoid default.
On Thursday, Governor Carey held another news conference and said President Ford's plan to help New York City solve its financial troubles would make the city a ward of the federal court and would also cost American taxpayers not less than $500 million for the first 3 months after New York's collapse.
A leading legal expert looked at it overnight and these words are his, not mine, but I think they are adequate to describe the bill. He said in the wording, the words of the bill are the words of Archie Bunker, and the music of the bill is the melody of Herbert Hoover.
Governor Carey then called on New Yorkers to turn out at a mass rally to show the nation that they were ready to fight back.
We're going to take a day, and we're going to turn out New York City. And we're going to form all over this town, and we're going to invite the people in from the suburbs as well, who have a stake in New York. And whether it's in Times Square or in Central Park or in all of the places where people gather, we're going to sound off in behalf of this great city.
No Those perhaps most hurt by the news that President Ford would not allow federal funds to guarantee New York City's finances were the little people. Mary Milstein of Brooklyn said she had her life savings of $20,000 tied up in municipal bonds.
I had a sick husband. I worked for years, brought up my children the best way I knew how. Saved, scrimped, saved a few dollars, and it went. All this money went into the bonds. Looking forward to someday I'd take it easy, and when I reach a certain age, I can just relax and not worry about anything. But it seems that this can never be.
The feelings of Mary Milstein were echoed on Wall Street. Immediately after President Ford's speech, prices on the New York Stock Exchange declined sharply, with the Dow Jones Industrials closing down nearly 13 points for the day. On Thursday, the stock market held its own, but on Friday, the Dow Jones average was down 3 more points. There were those who refused to give up on New York City bonds. Bruce Bumgarten of Hamilton Cook & Company said his firm was still buying.
We placed an ad in the New York Times looking to bid on New York City bonds in the midst of the present-day crisis. And we've had a tremendous response to our ad. Most people were concerned about the New York City bonds having a value. We've established there is a value for bonds even in the midst of default.
For those in Congress who refused to give up on the idea of federal aid to New York, on Thursday, despite President Ford's threatened veto, the Senate Banking Committee voted in favor of providing a $4 billion loan guarantee to New York City. Senator William Proxmire, the Democratic chairman of the committee, explained why he wasn't giving up.
People do deplore what's happened in New York. We prefer the course that we've chosen to follow that would prevent a bankruptcy, but require New York to balance its budget, require New York to reduce its spending, and require also the bondholders to take a reduction on their holdings.
The Senate aid bill passed the Banking Committee by an 8-5 vote. On Friday, the House Banking Committee voted 10-6 for a $7 billion package to aid New York. On Sunday, a new wave of violence erupted in Beirut, Lebanon. But this time, the factional fighting between left and right-wing gunmen spread to the downtown hotel district. The towering Holiday Inn complex became a strategic point of contention. Among those staying in the hotel was Enos Sherlid, a member of the Canadian embassy staff.
Seems to be quite a bit of nervousness. Foreigners are trying to get out, but we seem to be surrounded here right now, and there is intermittent fighting going on at this moment.
Also at the Holiday Inn was British businessman Mark Johnson.
There's a lot of firing going on. You could say there is machine gun or automatic rifle fire every 10 seconds, and bombs about 2 or 3 times an hour. This is closed stuff. But it's not safe to go on the balconies to observe, so people are staying well inside.
On Monday, the U.S. Embassy advised American citizens to evacuate dependents and non-essential personnel from Lebanon as gun battles continued to spread in Beirut, despite attempts at calling a ceasefire. One of those to leave was Mrs. Deidre Engelhardt of Washington, D.C., who talked with ABC's Beirut Bureau Chief Bill Zimmerman as she was checking out of the Riviera Hotel.
Mrs. Engelhardt, you're about to leave, I gather. Where are you going?
Tunisia. Rome and then Tunisia.
How do you feel about leaving?
Glad to leave now. I can't function anymore here. You can't get out of your apartment. This is all to leave. The noise at night is scary. You can't sleep.
Correspondent Zimmerman's wife, Patricia, and their children were also among those leaving Beirut. But the going wasn't easy, as crowds of foreigners waited for seats on one of the few flights out of the country. When she arrived in Paris, Patricia Zimmerman told of her difficulties.
I have not slept for 3 nights, so it's going to be a relief, you know, to just be able to lay down and not work, and sleep in a bed and not on the floor and worry about bullets and bombs and with the children, you know, to have them safe. It's just going to be nice.
On Thursday, as the civil war raged on in Beirut, UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim made an urgent appeal for the fighting to stop.
I'm sure that if the leaders and the people of Lebanon can now take a decisive step away from violence towards conciliation, they will find warm support in the United Nations and in the world at large for their efforts to set Lebanon once again on the path of peace and prosperity.
On Friday, correspondent Bill Zimmerman reported that Beirut had spent one of its quietest nights in a long time, with a new ceasefire apparently beginning to take hold. By week's end, however, shooting could still be heard in the streets of Beirut. On Wednesday night, terrorism struck once again in London. This time, a bomb was planted inside one of London's fashionable Italian restaurants. ABC's Hillary Brown described the scene.
The street here, this haven here, is just littered with glass. It was an enormous bang, one that I could hear from my home about a mile away. So the campaign of terror is still continuing. This has come just a week after a bomb placed under a car in another part of London killed one man. Hillary Brown, ABC News, London.
18 people were injured in the latest London bombing, which followed shortly after the arrest of 8 people suspected of taking part in the recent wave of London terrorism. The week began with the arrival in the U.S. of President Anwar Sadat, the first Egyptian president to pay an official visit to Washington. On Monday, President and Mrs. Sadat were the guests of President Ford at a state dinner. In his toast, President Ford had warm words for the Egyptian president.
Your courage, Mr. President, in taking the first steps toward peace after almost 3 decades of warfare assures your place in history in the Middle East, and we congratulate you for it.
President Sadat, in his toast, said he hoped his visit would further strengthen ties between the U.S. and Arab nations. But Sadat was firm in referring to the Palestinian question.
Americans can understand, perhaps better than any other people, man's attachment to his land. For this has been one of the main characteristics of the American culture. Such relationship instills in us a strong love for our country and a devotion to defend it no matter what the sacrifice is.
On Wednesday, President Sadat appeared before the United Nations, where he called for a resumption of the Geneva talks on the Middle East, talks which Sadat, through an interpreter, said should include the Palestinians.
It is high time and even imperative that the Geneva conference should resume its meetings with the participation of all the parties concerned with the Palestinian question.
President Sadat was also on a shopping trip. He wanted the U.S. to sell arms to Egypt, a request which put him in conflict with some pro-Palestinian groups. Dr. M.T. Mehdi of the Arab American Action Committee explained his position.
We are opposed to America giving arms to Israel and selling arms to Egypt. The issue in the Middle East is not Sinai. The issue is not the Golan Heights. The issue is Palestine. And the Sinai Agreement has completely neglected to recognize the issue.
On Thursday, President Ford announced he would ask Congress for nearly $5 billion in new foreign aid money, including nearly $1 billion in aid to Egypt and more than $2 billion in additional aid to Israel. On Saturday, President Ford made an unusual appearance on television. Only a few lawyers, court officers, and possibly a jury would see the program. In a president-breaking arrangement, the president agreed to comply with a judge's order that he give sworn testimony on videotape in the criminal case of Lynette Squeaky Fromm, charged with attempting to assassinate him in Sacramento September 5th. 2 lawyers and the judge presiding over the Fromm case flew to Washington for the taping, which took about 20 minutes. The issue of court-ordered busing was again in the news. On Monday, Senator John Tower of Texas met with President Ford and said the president still refuses to support a constitutional amendment against court-ordered busing, although the Republican senator said he was assured by the president that the administration would review alternatives to busing. Senator Tower said, nonetheless, he would continue to push for a constitutional amendment prohibiting busing.
We should proceed to attempt the constitutional amendment route because you have to make a starting point sometime. And I can't predict with any degree of accuracy what future decisions are likely to be handed down by the Supreme Court. And because the constitutional amendment does take a great deal of time, and it's a lengthy process, it has to be begun right away, in my view.
On Tuesday, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a round of hearings on the busing problem. Among those testifying was Professor James Coleman, a man whose earlier work helped bring about busing as a means to desegregate schools. The University of Chicago sociologist testified that he had changed his mind about the usefulness of court-ordered busing.
School desegregation, as it's been carried out in recent years, is increasing segregation between the city and suburbs. At the same time, it is reducing segregation within the city. In hindsight, 10 or 20 years hence, these policies designed to desegregate schools may well be seen as highly segregative policies instead.
Also testifying was Kentucky Governor Julian Carroll, who talked about the problems with busing faced in Louisville.
The harmful effects of forced busing in Jefferson County has created serious discipline problems. It has created problems with the loss of identity of the children with respect to their schools. It has completely disrupted family life in our community. And it's causing even a particular problem among our black students, who are the real losers, we think, as a result of forced busing in that county.
Another issue which has touched the minds of most Americans involves a 21-year-old woman who is being kept alive by a respirator. Karen Ann Quinlan has been in a coma so long, with no hope for recovery, that her parents went to a judge in Morristown, New Jersey, to get court permission to take her off the machine and, as they put it, let her die with dignity. New Jersey State Attorney General William Hyland talked of the moral dilemma surrounding the Quinlan case.
The increasing capability of medical science to keep people alive means that we are going to prolong life under circumstances that may not always be in the interest of the individual, and may in fact be very cruel and inhuman.
Karen Quinlan's parents say the main issue is the quality of life and the right to die as one's religion dictates. But Ralph Porzio, the attorney for Karen's doctors, says to allow Karen to die would be a dangerous medical precedent.
It would be highly dangerous to use the standard of quality of life in order to determine that one person, medically and legally alive, should die, and another person, medically and legally alive, should continue to live. It's an almost impossible standard.
A state judge in Morristown is expected to rule on the Quinlan case sometime during the next week. As the week began, it was apparent an end of an era was near as Spain's aging dictator General Francisco Franco hovered on the brink of death. Amid reports of Franco's imminent death from heart failure, Spaniards were preparing to accept Franco's hand-picked successor, Prince Juan Carlos, as their king. On Thursday, as Franco clung to life, Juan Carlos assumed the powers of chief of state. And on Friday, he presided over his first cabinet meeting. At week's end, the condition of General Franco remained grave. On Thursday, the South Vietnamese government released 9 Americans captured in South Vietnam last spring. Also freed were 2 Canadians, 2 Filipinos, and an Austrian. One of the Americans, Mrs. Carolyn Miller of Houghton, New York, talked with newsmen on her arrival in Bangkok.
This is a very happy moment for all of us. We are very grateful to be here. We would like to express our appreciation to the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and to the Provisional Revolutionary Government of the Republic of South Vietnam for allowing us to return to our homes and families.
Mrs. Miller was asked if she brought a message from the Vietnamese government.
Many times they expressed the hope that relations would be normalized between the two governments, and said that they felt that the American people were their very good friends, and that they hoped that in the future the diplomatic relations would be straightened out between the two countries, and that we would be free to visit them, and that they would be free to visit in our country.
Mrs. Miller said she and the other Americans held by the Vietnamese were treated well. And on Friday, reports from Saigon indicated all or most of the 26 Americans still known to be held in South Vietnam would be allowed to leave next month. On Wednesday, the Senate Intelligence Committee began public hearings. The first to testify was Lieutenant General Lou Allen, Jr., Director of the National Security Agency. General Allen admitted that between 1967 and 1973, his agency illegally scanned international telephone and cable traffic to intercept the messages of more than 1,600 American citizens. General Allen testified that some good had come from the so-called watch list operation.
We are aware that a major terrorist act in the United States was prevented. In addition, some large drug shipments were prevented from entering the U.S. because of our efforts on international narcotics trafficking. We have statements from the requesting agencies in which they have expressed appreciation for the value of the information which they have received from us. Nonetheless, in my own judgment, the controls which were placed on the handling of the intelligence were so restrictive that the value was significantly diminished.
But the means did not justify the ends, so said Committee Chairman Frank Church. The Idaho Democrat called on his committee to take action to prevent such surveillance by the NSA in the future.
As the capacity to monitor the private conversations of American citizens without the use of a bug or a tap. The interception of international communication signals sent through the air is the job of NSA, and thanks to modern technological developments, it does its job very well. The danger lies in the ability of the NSA to turn its awesome technology against domestic communication.
Senator Church urged his committee to make public a report on another aspect of spying by the National Security Agency called Operation Shamrock. It was later agreed, however, that the committee would submit the report to General Allen for his response without making the operation public. On Thursday, it was a happy ending to a standoff at the Society National Bank in Cleveland. Ex-convict Edward Watkins had tried to rob the bank, but a silent alarm tipped off police. He then took six hostages and held them for 20 hours until he was persuaded to give up. FBI agent Ed Haggerty was the first to talk to Watkins after his surrender.
I shook his hand and I thanked him for coming to the sense of surrendering as he ultimately did, and that there was no bloodshed here today.
With the end of October came Halloween, a time to resurrect old ghost stories for a child's imagination. But trick-or-treating as we used to know it may be on its way out. With all the reports of dangerous treats being handed out to youngsters every year, the Allied Civic Clubs of Houston came up with an idea to make Halloween safer. As Jim Assab explains, it involves a character new to the Halloween game called J.J. Lantern.
Parents tell their kids to trick-or-treat at only the homes that have the J.J. Lantern taped to the front door. When the kid goes to the front door, he'll trick-or-treat for the J.J. Pumpkin Nickels and Pumpkin Duels, which are worth 5 cents and 2 cents. Then he can turn around and redeem them within 30 days in the grocery store that's on the coupon.
Aesop says J.J. Lantern is able to ease the fears of parents while giving the kids what they want.
What we're trying to do is take the fear out of Halloween and turn it around and make it where they can trick-or-treat for paper money and turn around and buy something in the store, and there's no fear of getting any kind of poison in the candy or cakes or apples that are given away in the normal trick-or-treat.
So went This World This Week and the voices in the headlines. Voices in the headlines, the sounds of the news this week gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC News. Written and produced by Jeffrey Veach. Executive producer, Tom O'Brien. Directed by Bill Gately. Engineering by Cy Kantrowitz, Gene Carlson, and Bob Ireland. Special effects by Terry Ross. I'm George Caldwell, ABC News, New York. Voices in the headlines is a production of ABC News.